Call the meeting of the Health Policy and Finance Committee to order. We have quite a number of bills, so I'm going to ask those people presenting bills to be respectful of others who are, and please try to move things along for us. Our first bill is House File 3171, Representative Quinzing. If you'd come to the testifier and bring your testifiers as well. I'll move House File 3171 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman and members. This bill would allow parents of a child, a baby most of the time, to get a birth certificate even if the baby has died that doesn't say deceased across the birth certificate. Currently, if your baby's born and is sick when it's born and you're spending 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in the NICU, you may not think to go through the process of requesting an official birth certificate at that time that you're in the hospital with the baby. And if the baby dies and you do finally get around to requesting the official birth certificate, when it comes to you through the mail, it says deceased. It's on it, and it also has the date of death. So a parent has come to us today to kind of explain. She's the one who brought this issue to us to explain her story. And the request is simply for one clean birth certificate, and it could only be issued to the parents, and it could only be issued up to 6 years after the date of the birth. The reason for that time frame is because we made it so that it could be electronically tracked by the Department of Health. So the Department of Health has an electronic tracking system that would be able to identify that one had already been issued, and no more could be issued after that one clean one. All that would be issued after that would say deceased from there on out. So to explain her story as a parent who has gone through trying to get one of these clean birth certificate, I'll have Jen explain her story.
Good morning.
State your name for the record.
Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself as you begin, please.
Jennifer Strack. After my daughter Ella, 40 days, passed away, I realized I did not have a copy of a birth certificate. Being that Ella never left the hospital due to a congenital heart defect and two open heart surgeries that were ultimately unsuccessful, we as her parents never left the hospital. When I returned to work about a month after Ella passed away, I thought again about her birth certificate and stopped at the Hennepin County offices to obtain a copy. I was surprised at how easy it seemed to get the record, as I was only there for about 10 minutes and was able to quickly leave with an official copy. Moments later, I realized that it was an official document with the words "registrant deceased" typed on the form. I immediately went back to request a new copy, as I was certain there had been a mistake. The person I had dealt with was as confused as I was, and I was ultimately shuffled around to two other people who were supposed to be able to help me when ultimately I was given a number to call in an effort to plead my case. When I finally reached a live person on the phone, I was told that I could simply white out the words "registrant deceased." I didn't find this to be an appropriate solution. I was also told, had I thought to pick up Ella's birth certificate before she died, that I would not have had this problem. Unfortunately, I didn't think about that fact between juggling being at Ella's bedside and trying to stay sane about the fact that my firstborn was dying. If it had not been for a personal connection to someone that was able to put me in touch with the right person, I have a feeling I would still be deep in the process of obtaining a clean birth certificate. I've had many people ask me why I would waste my time with such a tedious thing, or that I should just cut those words out of the document. My answer to these statements is simple. Ella was born into a situation that no one could have foreseen, and she fought with all of her might for 40 days to live. Something as simple as a birth certificate represents just that fact. We have a death certificate reminding us that, yes, our baby is dead. But a birth certificate offers a chance for us to focus on Ella's life, a life of 40 days that she taught us more about perseverance, faith, and love than anyone ever could have. As a law-abiding citizen, I fully understand and agree with the importance of taking the appropriate precautionary measures in an effort to cut down on the number of identity theft fraudulent cases. However, it seems quite simple to me as the parent of a deceased child to provide an exception to the rule, so to speak. Imagine, if you can, the amount of emotional trauma and shock that a parent experiences after the loss of their child. The last thing that someone in this state should be faced with is being forced to plead their case as to why a clean birth certificate is so important to them. A life, no matter how short, is still a life. Please do not undermine the importance of that life and expect a grieving parent to have the ability to challenge the need for a clean legal document, which is so near and dear to their heart. Isn't it enough that their child is gone forever? Something as simple as an official birth certificate meant the world to me when all else was gone. It provided a sense of hope and reminded me that Ella's life meant so much, even if it was so tragically short. Thanks for your time.
Ms. Beck, I can't help but congratulate you, and it is not uncommon, but for you to take a situation, to go to the right place, to get that situation rectified this time forward, that's great citizen participation in our democracy.
Thank you.
Thank you. No questions. President Clinton, one thing, and maybe the health department can confirm, we have a fiscal note that doesn't show any cost. I'm assuming that the health department would confirm that there are no costs in implementing this bill. Yes, I don't see anybody, but has that been your indication?
They're here. We've been in discussion with them. This is simply a matter of just not stamping deceased on one of the certificates. This is stuff they already do. They already issue these certificates. It's just a matter of when. Is it before the death or after the death?
No, I didn't see any hand go up or anything. We're just going to proceed with that assumption. If that turns out to be wrong, that would mean it would unfortunately have to come back here, and I would just assume it not have to come back here. But we'll track that. Any discussion, members? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 3171 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. You understand that motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Representative Clinton. And thank you, the testifier. Our next bill is House File 2904, Representative Seifert. Representative Seifert, I'll move House File 2904. I believe we may be laying that over because there is a fiscal note. We can discuss that as we go on, but you'd like to proceed with your bill. Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2904 is something I discovered from school administrators who contacted me over the interim in regard to the legislature now starting feeing schools for something they never asked for. If members look at the bill itself and disregard the new underlying language, this is something that was in the omnibus bill last year, and I know there's probably a couple members here who were on that conference committee. And if you read the language on imposing the statewide hospitality fee, which is a new fee, and you read every person, firm, or corporation that operates a licensed boarding establishment, food and beverage service establishment, seasonal or temporary permanent food stand, special event food stand, mobile food unit, food cart, resort, hotel, motel, or lodging establishment, Minnesota must submit to the commissioner a $35 annual hospitality fee for each licensed activity. You know, I'm not an attorney. I don't know who on the committee is. Representative Thiessen would maybe be one. You know, do you see school anywhere in that definition when you're just, you know, a layman dummy like myself reading that is thinking, how did the schools get brought into this? Now, you know, you read that and tell me what you think.
Mr.
Thiessen, he wasn't asking you to confirm.
I just had a question. Does this cover preschools too?
Mr. Chairman, it would be my intent to, you know, anybody that's operating a school, I don't know, I suppose a preschool would be a school, but, you know, where the cafeteria is in place. What I'm saying, members, is I don't know that, you know, Mr. Chair, you were the head of the conference committee. I don't even know that you guys knew you were putting this in. The health department folks that I talked to privately about this said they weren't even sure that anyone knew that the schools were drug into this last year during the conference discussion.
Representative, I think it would be safe to say that if when you read it, it wouldn't be obvious to the person reading it that this applies to schools. Now, that
right.
doesn't mean it should or shouldn't. That just is a matter of
okay.
fact.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members, what I'm saying is that the legislature is really getting a bad reputation in terms of imposing fees on people. And no new taxes might be an interesting thing to banty about. But the bottom line is that when you have, and $35 is not going to break the budget of any school, but when you go to the average person and say, now we're going to start imposing fees on schools from the state legislature, we are going down a slippery slope of, particularly when they didn't ask for this and really didn't even realize they were included in this to start with. You know, I just think it's dangerous to get involved in this. Now, fiscal notice $85,000, my response to that is this program isn't even up and running, and to take $85,000 out of a program that doesn't exist, I think the committee would be safe sending this to Ways and Means. But if you decide not to, I'm okay with that. But I would say that the school districts I've had that have contacted me, and I've had four, all of them have said that A, they didn't ask for this, B, they resent paying it, C, if we get into the business of feeing schools, where is it going to stop, and D, we have been serving hot, nutritious, clean lunches to these students for 40 years, and to start a program now to somehow educate people about how to serve clean, hot, nutritious lunches, they already have training programs to do this, and we've been doing it for 40 years. And so, you know, whoever's going to come in and testify and say, you know, the world's going to end if we exempt this fee, we've been doing school lunches for decades and decades without any problems. You know, the governor said when he was criticized on the Canadian drug import bill, show me the dead Canadians. You know, I would turn that around and say, where are all the students laying around who have been poisoned by our school lunch program? There aren't any, because we have training programs in place right now. And so, members, I, in the strongest possible way, would urge you to send this to Ways and Means, or at least include it for a possible omnibus bill, because I don't think that we want to get into the business of starting to the fee process of schools. I do have Jan Allswiger here from Education Minnesota, I think, would like to comment also on the process of now we're going to kind of get into the business of nicking the schools on fees. It's just something I don't think we want to start, and as a legislature we should send the message, let's not even start feeing school districts, because it's just never going to stop, and it's going to start eroding the school budgets on the other end. So I'm, she's ready to testify on this.
Sure. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. I was going to, just before you do, maybe at least ask, so it gives you a feel for how strongly you have to sell. Is there anybody here that wishes to testify in opposition to this bill? Somebody show a hand. Okay. My suggestion is don't unsell, so welcome to the committee.
Thank you for that advice, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota, and I intend to keep my comments very brief. I think
thank
that
you.
This was an unintended consequence, and that we thank Representative Seifert for having a keen eye and ear in terms of listening for this and trying to fix it. I mean, you can imagine the additional staff if we start adding fees and reports and so on. So we would think that this is a bill that makes a lot of sense.
Makes sense. Thank you for your testimony.
Thanks, Jim.
If the health department is here, I believe that the it'd be helpful just to get a little bit of an understanding, because it looks like this is all special revenue, but just unravel a little bit, because I think Representative Seifert is making what may be a reasonable. I'm somewhat inclined, Representative Seifert, to hold it over and perhaps have a discussion with the chair of Ways and Means. You know, there's this minimalist kind of language, but that's pretty subjective. So I'd be happy to work with you and follow up. But welcome to the committee. If you'd introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Stein. I'm Acting Division Director for the Environmental Health Division in Minnesota Department of Health. I think the way that schools are included in paying the fee is they are a licensed establishment, and that is the nature of the reason that we became started the process of advising the school districts that they were required to pay the fee. All my understanding is that last year when the language was developed that there was some awareness. I would say the Representative Seifert is correct. There wasn't a thorough disclosure to all school districts or certainly to the Department of Education that that was the case. So I think you're partially correct that this is sort of a unintended consequence or a consequence of the words a licensed establishment is how they got included in mm-hmm. paying the fee. Beyond that, I could answer questions. I can tell you generally there's approximately 2,400 school districts that are licensed, we estimate. That's what we know, and that's how we calculated the fiscal impact.
Mr. Stein, just a quick one. we can see what the numbers are. I'm assuming that the health department has staff to perform whatever it is that's behind this. With that revenue gone, does that have any effect on the department as far as the staffing you need to perform these hospitality reviews or whatever all going on?
Mr. Chairman, the impact is essentially one staff person and associated travel and assistance for conducting training and audits of facilities, assisting with HACCP plans and so forth. It isn't a complete reduction of the staff, but there was some redirection of our performance-based block grants that created a hole which these funds were intended to fill, and so we will reduce staffing somewhat. We will still have staff available to assist restaurants and other licensed facilities with training and education and additional database development that we're doing for emergency notifications. But this amount of money would reduce the program by approximately one person. We're looking at staffing to a level of 6 to 7 positions.
Representative Otremba.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Seifert, last year the feds also asked us as schools to be inspected twice, and we set the fees. I think I'm hearing more about the number, the $300 that were now assessed as a federal inspection, and I believe we set that here in the state. So have you looked at that? That dollar amount is a lot larger than $35, and I'm hearing more complaints about the double, and although it's a federal thing, that inspecting twice of the year is really taking a lot of money out of their budgets.
Right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Otremba, I have heard about this. It is a requirement from the federal government that we have to do two inspections. I guess the second inspection is optional, but if you decide not to do it, they're going to take your school lunch program away or your federal block grants. Well, what are you going to do? You don't have a choice. So I have heard about that. I guess what I would say is if they're going to pay the inspection fee twice, why should we do this one? I mean, we're kind of piling on is what I'm saying. And there is a necessity to do the first fee that was imposed. And it did go through the committee process where everybody said, hey, we kind of have to do this. For this particular one, you know, my understanding is the schools really didn't know that they were being included in this thing. They didn't ask for it. They've been doing school lunches in a clean and sanitary and nutritious way already for 40 years. So, you know, not funding $85,000 or $83,000 for a program that really doesn't exist right now. I would say if we're going to do this, we should do it now, because once we get addicted to the money, and then next year it'll be $50, and the year after it'll be $75, and we're going to hire more people to help and assist and all that, it'll never go away. So I guess my thought process is at least nip this one in the bud, because I thought we had a good argument made by the schools. They really didn't know about it. It wasn't on anybody's radar screen. The other one's more expensive, obviously. This one, you know, when he said 2,300 schools, that'd be 2,300 buildings. There's about 360 school districts. So it really, for the bigger school districts, it's more money, because like a St. Paul, Minneapolis are going to have a lot of different buildings, and some of my school districts have one building, K-12. But, you know, I think for the most part, it's the annoyance that it caused and the precedent that it starts in flying under the radar. I did meet with Mr. Stein, and he answered every question I had. I don't remember what the full budget was, couple million or something?
It's approximately $700,000, their total budget.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Stein, does the Department of Health have a position on this bill?
Mr. Stein?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do not.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you for your testimony. That's helpful. Okay. Any further discussion or any further testifiers?
Right.
Seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 2904, the Chair will lay over House File 2904 for possible inclusion, then we can have a discussion if something changes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, appreciate it.
Representative Gazalka. I'll move House File 2878 for possible inclusion. Representative Gazalka, I also see that we have an amendment in our packet.
Is that correct, Mr. Chair?
I think the summary that we have is based on that first engrossment. I'll move the A1 amendment. Could you explain to the committee briefly what the amendment does?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members. The amendment is really birthed out of the Commerce Committee. The first one, page one, delete line 8, individuals applying for medical assistance on the basis of being aged, blind, and disabled. That was from DHS's perspective to conform with federal guidelines and have something that could work, basically, from their standpoint. The second part there is the part that came out of Commerce, and that's there was some concern from the committee members there that we were creating another tax loophole, that it would be a place for tax sheltered money for wealthy people, and that really wasn't the intent of the reason I brought forth the bill. So we limited the life insurance policies to $50,000, no more than $25,000 of cash value, and they have to be enforced for at least 5 years. And I'll explain that when I present the bill.
Okay. I understand the motion is to adopt Amendment A1, which gets the bills in the form that the author will explain to us today. All those in favor, say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Gazelle, continue your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill was really birthed out of my other life as an insurance agent. A couple times a year, I have particularly elderly clients coming into my office. They tell me that they have to cash out their life insurance policy because they're now needing medical assistance. And I considered it a waste of their resources, what they could have had for their family, but also a waste for the state of Minnesota. The state typically doesn't get these resources either. And so I handed out a copy of a life insurance policy, a typical life insurance policy. And if I can just take just a couple of minutes, Mr. Chair, to give that example, I'm sure that I can go ahead and do that. So if you see this particular example of $25,000 of life insurance, that's the number 2 on the sheet, $25,000 of life insurance. And follow that down to the bottom right of the sheet, I've circled number 1. That shows how much cash value is in this policy. $9,500. In this particular example, this person would have to cash out this policy to get medical assistance. The state doesn't get this. They usually spend it on other things, whatever they want to spend it on. And so what I'm proposing is rather than just have them spend it, they can choose to take that life insurance policy and sign an agreement with the state where they split the life insurance benefit with the state. So that particular benefit would be the numbers 2 and the number 3. So a total of almost $32,000 of death benefit they would split with the state. In effect, that would be about whatever that works out to be, $16,000 apiece, versus the way we do it right now in the state of Minnesota. The state gets nothing. That older woman that I just described in this example has no life insurance for her family, and she has spent the money to be eligible for medical assistance. So that's the purpose of this bill. I can tell you when I first drafted it, I got a fiscal note of $20 million, which was because they just didn't have any understanding of what I'm trying to do. And so we are continuing to work on that, and they recognize that that's way too high. But the exact number we'll have to find out. That's the brief version, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Representative Gazelka, as I read through, I mean, I'm sympathetic to the cause, but I struggle a little bit about, and I think you've helped it a bit by putting some of those caps on, but just the notion, we've tried very hard to not have, well, actually to try to close existing loopholes.
Yes.
Give me a sort of a feel of how you feel that this doesn't potentially open an additional loophole.
Mr. Chair, members, this actually increases cash to the state of Minnesota. Because in this example, that's why I wanted to hand out a real live example. Under this scenario, this person would come in and cash that policy. I don't issue that check to the state of Minnesota. I give it to them and they spend it. There's nothing that goes to the state. Versus if they enter this agreement, because there's so much life insurance, splitting that benefit with the state, in effect, the state ends up with $16,000 that they would not have had, and the person's beneficiaries gets the other $16,000. So the only cost that I see in most cases to the state is the administrative cost of setting this up, but over the years I see this as generating more money for the state.
Yeah. Well, I think I understand. The difference would be that on the cash value, that's kind of an immediate effect right now. The having, if you will, almost a lien on the life insurance benefit is a deferred effect.
Yes.
So there could be an effect that way, affecting that somebody becomes eligible for medical assistance that perhaps wouldn't have been eligible before, and that would be part of probably a fiscal note that we would get.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I picked $25,000 cash value because that would be, you know, a policy of roughly around $50,000 or so of coverage. But many of the policies I see that where clients come in, it's a $10,000 life insurance policy. The cash is $5,000 or $6,000. You know, the state is not going to get any of that money. And so that's where I recognize it as a benefit to the state. But, you know, and so it's almost like the state is buying a life insurance policy that they're going to get money in the future that's higher than what they would get right now.
We do have a preliminary fiscal note. However, I'm a little surprised that we wouldn't have some first, second year effect because it's being deferred and that doesn't show. So that's why we're holding over, because I have a hunch numbers will slide into this fiscal note.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if that's the $20 million fiscal note, keep in mind that they assumed that everyone that was getting medical assistance per year had $20,000 of cash value in life insurance, and it's way, way out of proportion. But
Representative Gazelka, I've just been corrected. The reason that it shows zero is that because it has a federal waiver, the department typically does not assume approval of that, so they don't fiscal note anything, but the commentary gives us some hint about that.
Yeah.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gozalka. It on page 2, subdivision 3, with the agreement of the commissioner, these are irrevocable written agreements, even if they're not on medical assistance. They may have been on a year and then they go off, and they have got to retain that contract with the commissioner. Can you explain that to me?
Representative Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, Representative Otremba, this is an option for the person that chooses to enter into it. They do not have to enter into this agreement. They could choose to do something entirely different. But the way it stands right now in the state, if they would have to spend down or cash out that policy and would never have it, the irrevocable beneficiary or irrevocable arrangement is only for up to half of the life insurance benefit. The way we've worded it, frankly, if they didn't use, let's say they only used 10% of the life insurance or medical expense costs were 10% of that benefit, that's all the state would collect. In other words, they could conceivably get 90% of life insurance back, not 50%.
Mr. Chair, I don't understand why. Excuse me. Thank you. I just don't understand why it has to be irrevocable at all if you've paid it off, and why should the state be involved with that whole process of retaining it, even if they're not on medical assistance and they've paid their bill?
Representative Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, Representative Otremba, this is a better benefit for the consumer than where we are right now. That doesn't mean that couldn't change in the future, that if they paid off their medical assistance, they could be released from this. I don't have that clause in here, but I certainly wouldn't be opposed to that if they paid their responsibility, that they could be released. That's a good idea.
Thank you.
I guess that's it. Anybody else have any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Abler.
This is being held over. This is the last stop this bill has to go to. Is that right?
Yeah.
So if this is put in the omnibus or something, or it goes off again, that's an amendment that might be easily offered at that time. It seems like this is a very creative idea. And I think that the system is, in some of these areas, is really lacking for creative ideas. So I looked at the fiscal note, and it's the most curious fiscal note. It's a cash flow thing. There's a little more money going out, but if this was in effect for 10 years, just talking to staff and reading this, it sounds like we'd make money in that.
Absolutely.
But it's a back-end loaded money thing. But so if we're in the long-term business, the state's going to be here for a good long time.
And so I think if there's a way to make this work, I think we should apply for the waiver and do it.
Well, I like the idea overall. The practicality is that we run on a biennial budget, and I'm not surprised that it'd be front-end loaded because it's a different change. But it's fair. I mean, I think it's absolutely fair, and it's actually, in the long run, I think good for both sides.
Mr. Chair, that's my intent, and you know, I've worked with George Hoffman with the fiscal note after I got it, and he acknowledges that he just didn't have ways to calculate the numbers very well, and so we're still trying to work with the insurance industry to get more accurate numbers.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, if I may make one last comment related to when I see these policies come through. I don't see somebody with a large life insurance policy applying for medical assistance. They typically haven't purchased that unless they were typically better off than the person that buys the smaller policies and then goes to medical assistance. That's why, just from my experience, I know that this would be a benefit to the state.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if I asked before. I'll just repeat if I did. Is there anyone that wishes to testify regarding this bill? See no one. Chair will lay over House File 2878 as amended for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Gazelka, and congratulations on some creative thinking. Oops, not what I do with mine. Representative Erickson.
Do with mine. Oh, I covered it up somewhere.
Representative Erickson, I'll move House File 2564. Let's see. Does that one be held over? Okay, for possible inclusion. Representative Erickson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. There is an amendment, Mr. Chair, that should be added before I discuss the bill.
Sorry, Representative Erickson, I missed that. Amendment A1, I'll move Amendment A1. Is this just to get it in the form that you'll discuss this morning?
Yes, Mr. Chair, okay. It's clarifying language.
All those in favor of A1 say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Erickson, do another bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. This bill would exempt aid and attendance benefits that a veteran receives from the United States Department of Veterans from being included in family income for Minnesota CARE eligibility. However, the aid in attendance would be counted as income for the individual who receives the benefit. This situation came to me, and I don't think there are very many of these in our state. I think the fiscal note shows 3 to 5, maybe. So there is a cost to the state. You do have a fiscal note in front of you. However, it's minimal. But I did have an experience in my district with a wife who needed care and couldn't qualify for Minnesota CARE. So with the help of someone in our constituent services, in fact, it was Elaine Fair, who was so kind to help me, we were able to discuss with the department what was the intent of Minnesota CARE, and did the intent of the bill ever include aid in attendance for veterans. And I also went about checking the original Minnesota CARE bill, and I just don't think that Minnesota CARE and veterans were linked back when the program was created. But now this crops up because we have a few veterans who have wives who are quite a bit younger who need, you know, health insurance. They come seeking Minnesota CARE and then find out what their spouse receives in aid and attendance. May be misunderstood as income for them, too. And remember, aid in attendance is tracked very carefully by the federal government, and anything that's not used has to be returned. So, Mr. Chair and committee, I think this is more conforming language than anything, because Veteran Administration aid in attendance is counted in every other program as third-party payment, and it's not counted as income for the non-VA spouse, you know, who is attending to his or her veteran.
Let's see if we can help things along a little bit.
Yes.
It appears as though the big cost really is our wonderful health match has got
correct,
us again.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
I don't know what the effect would be, but if we found an effective date that eliminated that, it seems like you're in the ballpark of minimalistic. It could go directly to the floor.
I agree, Mr. Chair.
Is that reasonable? And we would need some help maybe from the department about
yes.
what that date needs to be. But it's really a shame to stop this because of the health care, and it's
Correct.
A big program we have, and this apparently this would cause them to have to do some kind of extra work or delay. But if we could get a little advice from the department about what date would we need in order to remove the health match impact. And then you can decide, Representative Erickson, whether that works for you or not, but it sure looks like the estimate in the actual Minnesota Care cost looks like $3,000 or something,
Correct,
so it's practically nothing. Okay, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Karen Giusto, DHS. Yes, if the effective date on this proposal were moved to January 1, '09, which is a post-health match implementation, your system's cost would be very, very much reduced. And I can quantify that if you'd like.
I mean, 09 is the rollout so that it's all over the state. It's not, I mean, the program is done, but we just got word that the rollout's going to be delayed, so, well, that's what I understood, was that that's why it's gotten even further out now. I guess this is not a, this is not another chance to discuss too much about Health Match. I asked a question, I got an answer. It's just that it sets me aghast
yeah.
every time I hear the answer. But Representative Erickson, you heard the answer. Could you live with a that effective date?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
Then we can
yes.
send it right to the floor. If we can instruct the staff, let's see, we would be changing.
Thank you.
Where is that in the bill?
1.22.
On line 1.22, we would be changing July 1st, 2006. I think it was to January 1st, 2009. Was that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. I also wanted to note, however, that this would need federal approval to yes. change the Minnesota Care waiver.
I understand that, right.
Yes.
But that doesn't change. So I will move the amendment then on line 1.22 to change the date July 1st, 2006 to January 1st, 2009. You all understand that amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify regarding this bill? See no one. I'll change my motion. I'll move that House File 2564 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Even if it's de minimis, doesn't it have to go through Ways and Means?
I suppose we better ask him. For three?
You'll get dragged in there.
All right.
We might be able to get to the floor if we go direct.
You never heard my gavel fall, okay? I'll change my motion. My motion would be that House File 2564 be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, and that probably is the proper thing to do. Thank you for the advice. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Just trying to help you out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
I have to go?
We're here to help.
We got the gavel.
Representative Soderstrom. I will move House File 2147 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Representative Soderstrom, to your bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would like to make a couple of small amendments to this bill.
You have small amendments to this bill. Do you have those, the oral amendments?
Oral amendments, yes.
All right, give us your first idea.
Okay. On line 16, remove the comma and put and at orientation. And at orientation. And then the next change is line 17. And cross afterward jail, cross off for violating a law prohibiting, and then go on line 18, take all of it off except for with. Leave the with on. and line 21, cross off methamphetamine and put all. And then on the back page on line 3, page 2, change the date to 2006. This is a bill that we had last year.
All right, did everyone get that? I will repeat it. You want me to repeat it again?
You've got to move it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to I will move the oral amendments, and I just want to make sure staff has that. Okay. Maybe you want to repeat it to make sure that we have it accurate. I don't know if I wrote it down right or not.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would read page 1, line 16, after week, insert and at orientation and delete the comma. And then lines, page 1, line 17, delete everything after jail. Line 18, delete everything up until with. And then line 21, delete methamphetamine and insert all. Then on page 2, line 3, delete 2005 and insert 2006.
Thank you. That is the amendment. Representative Soderstrom, to that amendment, do you want to explain a little bit, or is this to get it in the shape that your
yes.
testifiers are ready to testify?
Yes.
Okay, well, then I'll move that amendment. Members, any questions? See no questions, we'll proceed to vote on the oral amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Amendment passes. Representative Soderstrom, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members, I am Representative Judy Soderstrom. I represent District 8B. And House File 2147 is a bill which requires the Commissioner of Health to develop methamphetamine offender education materials and requires that the sheriff present those materials to the offenders that are in the local jail. And I want to explain and apologize for the changes, but this morning, yesterday, I called Minnesota Teen Challenge and I asked if they had some gentlemen that they would be willing to come and testify about if they ever got any information in the jail about methamphetamine and the dangers, and they sent over these three gentlemen this morning, and as we were talking, they talked that at the jail they have an orientation, and that is the reason that it would be very well when they come in, they have an orientation that tells them what the rules of that jail are, you know, about the laundry and about their canteen money or what, all those things, they go over them, and that would be an opportune time. Almost every jail also has a nurse, and that nurse does a quick physical and goes over issues with them. So that would be an orientation, would be an excellent time for that presentation. Then also, there within the jail system, that is probably a hothouse for crime. So even if you happen to be in there on an alcohol or other charge, it would be very good for you to have this information about the dangers of methamphetamine. So that's why I took it off the information that just says just to those that are in on a violation of meth, but just that everyone would get it. So that's the reason for my changes. And I'm not going to say much more, and I'm just going to ask each of these gentlemen just to explain if they ever had any methamphetamine charges. They'll introduce themselves and then just give you a little background about their meth. And I know you're in a hurry, and so they're not going to take much time, but you certainly can ask them some questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Soderstrom. To the testifiers, if you could please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. Just keep in mind we have a few more bills here and we have to be out here by noon, so if you could keep it quick. I appreciate you being here. And if you want to start, introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
I'm Uriah Davis. I spent a little bit of time in Faribault and St. Cloud prison for meth charges. Upon arriving to prison, I was mandated for treatment, and through the whole time I was in prison, you know, which I went to prison with the idea that I've made some mistakes, I know that I'm not perfect, I made imperfect decisions, that I would be taught how to change my life in this situation. Upon arriving to prison, there was no basis on any kind of change at all. It was more like a breeding ground for worse criminals. You know, everybody's together. Everybody, all they do is sit and ponder new ways and better ways to be worse criminals. And I had no type of rehabilitation except for the fact that I was taken away from my family. And now, you know, along with these gentlemen, I know they feel the same way, that we're at a place where we're learning this. You know, we're learning a new way of life, and that our life doesn't have to be the way that it was. So I think it'd be really good to introduce the dangers of meth to everybody in the whole spectrum of crime in these jail systems. Be definitely a good thing, because meth is definitely ruining everybody's life that touch their hands on it.
Thank you, Mr. Davis.
My name is Paul Anderson. I was incarcerated in Lino Lakes Prison, medium security in Lino Lakes, Minnesota, and yet I can testify to the fact that I didn't receive any kind of in the orientation when I came into the jail or just any kind of treatment or anything. I'll agree with what he was saying. You know, it's a breeding ground. I learned, you know, a lot better ways of doing what I was, you know, pretty much what I was doing, you know, better. I pretty much just agree with what he said. And, I'll testify to the fact that, you know, I think we do need that information into the orientation. You know, that orientation setting in the jail when we first come in, it would really help. I think it'd be really beneficial to the inmates that come in. Maybe it'd give them some closure on, you know, man, I want to stay away from that stuff. Because I mean, I know for me, it's pretty much it's took everything that I owned and destroyed a lot of relationships. So, but now, like he said, I'm just pretty much. Just gaining those back and but thank you very much, yep. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Proceed with testimony. Please state your name for the record.
Hi, my name is Eric Jones. I was incarcerated in St. Cloud prison at 17 years old for meth use, and all that happened there is I learned how to make meth better. The recipe wasn't as good as it should have been, and it was just a fun and games thing. I'm from Southwest Minnesota, and the jails there ain't as big as Hennepin County or Ramsey County, and I think this is one of the greatest ideas I've ever seen, actually. I've heard the sheriff say that there's not time or it's not going to work or anything like that, and I think when they're watching a football game all season long, or watching a basketball game in March Madness, I think they could be doing a little bit of handing out materials or showing us a movie on meth. You know, I don't really see how watching a football game is doing their job or really putting any effort into why they're working there. But I just think this is really good. If somebody would have showed me these things when I was 15 or 16 years old, when I first went to jail, it would probably would have saved a lot of things for me, would have done a lot for me instead of sending me to prison at 17. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all three for being here today. Representative Soderstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. That's all I have. I do have somebody here from the Health Department that would be developing the materials to be shown, and perhaps he has a few words to say.
I have Mr. Stein on my list here. Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Stein. I'm the Acting Director of Environmental Health at the Minnesota Department of Health. Just quickly on the, there's a fiscal note for the bill, and just wanted you to know that the note was prepared on the assumption that the department would contract for production of a video specifically oriented toward Minnesota. That is not necessarily the only means of getting the information, and we do at present finding some information that other states have prepared, and we're trying to assemble those videos and some private treatment center videos, and we're trying to use what we can from existing sources and perhaps reduce or eliminate the fiscal impacts of the bill. But at this point, we are able to assure Representative Soderstrom and the committee that we'd be able to prepare some written materials and other materials that would be available on the dangers of methamphetamine use and production from what we already have as source materials. So I just wanted to make those comments for the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stein. Any questions, members? Representative Otremba.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's not necessarily a question, but and I rarely do this, but I just want to thank Representative Soderstrom. I don't know anybody who does more for prison ministry, and I don't know anybody who does that, who gives more people hope that they can be who they are.
Thank you.
All right. I have a note here that is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify against this bill? Please come forward and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, my name is Steve Borkart. I'm the sheriff of Olmsted County and representing and speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. While we have no quarrel with the sentiments of the bill, certainly most of us sheriffs are involved in very comprehensive programming of various sorts in our facilities. And we have to speak against the bill the way it's written because it will constitute quite an unfunded mandate for quite a few sheriffs and the one-size-fits-all inclusive nature in which every sheriff is mandated to do the same thing the same way is going to present a burden to all of your sheriffs. For example, some sheriffs don't have jails, and the bill is unclear as to whether or not it is the arresting agency sheriffs that is required to provide this information or the sheriff that is running the jail where the persons are so incarcerated. Number two, some sheriffs are still running very small jails with very limited facilities where they have jailer dispatchers. And with all due respect to the testimony, the anecdotal story about jail staff watching football games and what have you, there are certainly other situations where that's not the case and the staff is not available to be able to present this material on an every week basis. Third,
Mr. Chair. Representative Dean.
Could these concerns be raised perhaps in the Public Safety Committee moving forward? Or
Representative Dean, this bill is going to the Public Safety Committee. It would be my let me get to your last name. Is it Borchard?
Borkart, yes. Sir.
Borkart, sorry. Sheriff Borkart is addressing some of those concerns that I believe probably should be handled in the Public Safety Committee. If you can relate it to, and I know you maybe don't completely know our jurisdiction because I don't think we know sometimes our jurisdiction, but related to the Health Committee, we would appreciate that.
Well, Mr. Chair, let me conclude then by saying the sentiment behind this is good. If these folks, if just information will prevent addicted people from continuing their addiction, we're all for it. If this could be couched within the current DOC regulations with incentives provided for grants, for best practices kinds of treatment programs that start while people are incarcerated in jails and then continue on in their prison setting and continue on beyond that into the probationary setting with long-term intensive supervision, I think most sheriffs would be happy to participate in a longer-term project that has a high probability of providing good productive results. But simply providing information to people that are already addicted has a dubious chance of much success compared to the expense that is going to be required in delivering the product. That would be my conclusionary statement. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Sheriff. Members, any questions? Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, I would, however, well, two things. First of all, I'd say to Sheriff Borkart, out of respect for having taken the time to be here this morning, it's fair for us to hear because it's a bigger consideration. And the second part is, as we move this on, even though I absolutely agree with the intent, I think we also have to be thinking about not only the cost to the state, but cost of other things and what the consequences. We've had too many occasions of not thinking about unfunded mandates, at things that sound good. And I'm not trying to disparage a proposal, but I think what the sheriff brings to us is a very important picture for us to think about as this thing moves along. And that's a consideration for all of us legislators, I think, that we all are mindful. In fact, if I remember right, there may be, it seems like we have something in law that says that we should, where there are effects other places, that we should actually have some estimates of those. And whether it's in law or not, it would might be helpful as this thing moves through public safety for the sheriff to give some sort of an idea. I mean, you gave us an idea, I think, in concept, but if there's any way to quantify that for the public safety committee, because they would be the ones that they would see, but it wouldn't come into fiscal mode again. And I do have one other question. If I'm reading it right, and this would be directed to Representative Sostrom, it looks like it's being directed to county jails and those facilities. The testifiers were in prison settings. Tell me about that.
Representative Sostrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, we discussed before they, I didn't meet them until 10 o'clock, and so I explained my bill, and they all told me, they didn't quite say that here, but they told me, and they could come back and say that they did not receive any information in the jails that they were in, any time that they have been in jail. And if you ask them, I think many of them have been in jails quite a number of times. There was no material, and nothing was ever mentioned to them about methamphetamine and the dangers that it what it does to their system and their life and so forth. So they've all been in prison, and they've also said that never in prison did anyone give them any information about methamphetamine, or they didn't see a video or get literature about the dangers of methamphetamine. So I didn't bring this about jail or prisons. I just brought this about jails. And I do a faith-based ministry in two jails, Pine County and Kanawha County. And I just don't think that I'd be happy to do it in my own jail. I mean, I could be there for every time for an orientation, but once a week would be no problem for me to go three blocks from my home, show a video, and I have friends that would do that free. So I don't know that you could say that it's going to be an unfunded mandate, because there are local groups. We have a meth task force in our county, and Pine County has one. Those people would be very happy to spend the $50, $100 for the video and to furnish the materials. So I do think that it's something that we really need to, if we can make a difference in 5 or 10% of people and stop the expanding of methamphetamine, it would be worth the effort. Thank you.
Representative Bradley?
Mr. Chair, just one final. You may then come to some of the options you're thinking about. The language in the bill, however, is quite prescriptive in terms of the sheriff providing once a week, et cetera. If you're thinking of flexibility for volunteers or those kinds of things, perhaps that might be something you want to think about. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Goodwin.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I have a comment or question for the sheriff. My first real information about the effects of meth, even though I thought I knew about meth, were in this committee last year when we had extensive hearings, and I was really really wowed by those hearings and really learned a lot about the problems that meth creates, and the physical problems as well as the mental health problems and so forth. I guess I'm a little surprised that this isn't already a practice in the jails and so forth. I'm a little surprised that we had to bring a bill forth to do that, because I would think that part of your jobs would be to educate the public and educate the people that come into your jail. So I'm just a little surprised that it's not like the Sheriff's Association to come in and protest something like this that would be so good for public information and to stop this problem that the sheriffs are all, or at least reduce this problem that the sheriffs are all complaining about and all the local police officers are complaining about. So with or without this bill, I would really hope that there would be a much stronger effort in the state for people to understand the horrible effects of meth, and that you folks would be standing behind that all the way, and in fact, bringing it forth yourself. So thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair,
Chair
Representative, did you want a response?
Sure.
I would say that a majority of the sheriffs are engaged in community education and have varying levels of programming available in their jails. The issue here is more the unfunded mandate of, as the chair pointed out, the prescriptive nature of the language that doesn't give us much discretion relative to whether or not somebody is on disciplinary status. Do they still have to have it? How are the materials going to be provided? Do we know that just providing people with some materials is going to be favorable versus treatment? Most of the people, by the time they hit our jails, are requiring treatment. Certainly, if we can make this argument for this particular societal ill, then we should be doing the same thing for every drug that somebody can be addicted to. Every domestic abuser should get information. And while that sounds real good, we don't have the resources at the local level to implement that kind of planning, which is why I suggested if we want to do this in the context of the DOC regulations that we currently work under, with grants and incentives for implementation of best practices kinds of treatment and therapies that begin in the jail, I think we have something we can really talk about. But just mandating handing out some brochures and watching a video is, I think, of dubious value compared to the expense and of putting it on.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow up on that, I don't think anybody believes that this is the cure-all for meth and abuse, and I think that, but it's certainly education, public education is so important, and I think some of the points that were made here about volunteers, and I know, I bet these young men here would be interested in talking to other people that have meth problems and what a good reinforcement that would be for them to as well, and I've seen it work in drug programs in schools, and the kids tell me when I worked in mental health that, and they had chemical dependency problems as well, they told me that the people they listened to the most were the people that were young people that had had the problem, and I think, you know, it doesn't have to be about more money and more grants. There can be ways to do this that I think would be very beneficial to the community and to you and your officers.
Thank you.
All right. Anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, members, any further questions on the Soderstrom bill? Representative Samuelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just to the point that Representative Goodwin was talking about, is that anything we can do to get information into people's hands, the better. And it's certainly a lot better than doing nothing.
All right, members, any further questions? Seeing no further questions, I will renew my motion that House File 2147, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Members, we'll take a vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion passes.
Much as you want, because I got another bill I'm up later on.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move that House File 3111 pass and be sent to the General Register.
Representative Dean moves that House File 3111 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Dean, to your bill.
This bill is the chemical border bill, and what this does is it looks at cities like Stillwater, which is in my district, which have folks in the Lakeview Hospital in Stillwater has 30% of the patients are from Wisconsin, and many of the folks in Stillwater live in Wisconsin, and they work in Stillwater, and they also receive their medical care in Stillwater. And for many other border communities, for example, Representative Huntley in Duluth would have similar situations with folks living in Wisconsin. What this does is it allows folks who live in a bordering state to receive chemical dependency treatment in Minnesota and have that paid for through the home state. So currently what happens is that they receive their medical care, they receive mental health treatment in Minnesota, but for chemical dependency treatment they have to travel back to their home state, and it provides a hindrance for those folks and a barrier to recovery. And that's something obviously we don't want to see, particularly with more than 80% of all of these folks not receiving dependent folks not receiving treatment. So this bill goes about correcting that. I was approached with this bill, and the first thing that I did was go to my county, Washington County, and get their thoughts on it. They were very much in support of it, provided, of course, that the dollars flow with those patients from their home state. Then I approached DHS and talked with them about it, and they are also in support of this bill. And I received a fiscal note as that's being passed out that shows no cost to the state. I know of no opposition to this bill, and I'm very happy to present it. Bob Melson, Executive Director of Dakota County Receiving Center, is here. If any members have questions about the general mechanics or transfer of dollars from border states or just how this might be implemented by a county-by-county basis. With that, I'll open it up for questions.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Members, any questions? Seeing no questions, I think we're...
Anybody else that wants to test?
Does anyone?
No.
Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, no further questions from members. Representative Dean will renew his motion that House File 3111 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion passes.
Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 3283 be recommended to pass and be referred to Commerce.
Representative Abler moves that House File 3283 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on Commerce. Representative Abler, it's your bill.
And let me just talk about the general idea of this, then I have an amendment to offer. This is the conforming language to the long-term care partnership. Last year, I think it was, we had Minnesota passed, I think, one of the best long-term care partnership bills, I think, in the country. We had a two-tier version which left this committee, I think, as a and what we wound up with coming out of Commerce, out of the Conference Committee, was a plan whereby if you would buy a three-year qualifying plan for long-term care, you would be exempt from state recoveries, totally exempt. And it was a very good policy you had to buy. Otherwise, the second version was that we allowed if you would buy any old policy, you'd be exempt dollar for dollar. The feds have acted, and I think in this case have chosen a poorer course. In many of the features I'll present to you. But they only allow dollar for dollar on some rather strictly qualifying plans. And I think they took the worst of both. And so what this bill reflects is the conformances that are required to do that, to make it work. And there's a few decision points that we do have about. One is of dates of beginning. There'll be a waiver filed, or a plan, an amendment or something filed with the feds. I think September 30th is the plan under this bill. And they would backdate then to any policies sold to July 1st of 06 of this year that would be qualifying. What I remain unconvinced about is that how the long-term, like the Gazelkas of the world, who are just here, who are going to have a hard time selling plans in July, August, and September, hoping that they'll be grandfathered in under the amendment that will be the plan that will be filed with the feds. I'm not satisfied with the answers I've got yet, although I'm assured that it's going to be fine. This bill has a large fiscal note, and so I'll be coming back to it anyway. By the time I get back to you, I'll have some language that will make me comfortable with that. Other decisions have to do with how much the state recovery we allow and some of the nuances about that, and also some of the training. And I have an amendment that I can offer to you, which describes that. If I could offer now, Mr. Chair, the A4 amendment.
Representative Abler moves the A4 amendment. Representative Abler, to your amendment.
Mr. Chair, and there's a technical, there's a change on it, on line 1.4.
I knew there would be.
Representative Abler. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry about that. I'll just let it go. The May, it came from the audience, Mr. Chair, not from me. So, on line 1.4, the May should be a shall, and then delete the word ensures. So that the commissioner shall approve producer training requirements, et cetera. And anyway, so the bill, Article 1 of the bill that's in front of you is pretty technical on how you're supposed to post things and so on. This has to do with the training. And the idea is that we want the training to be reasonable, but we don't want to make it onerous. We don't want to have it be longer than, more than it needs to be, or more in the future than it needs to be. And there's unfortunately we're really bound by the federal stuff on a lot of this, and so we're conforming to that. There may be another touch-up bill for this whole thing coming next year to fix the bugs that we found. The rest of the amendment goes through, it talks about protected assets, has some definitions, and those have been agreed to by the different parties who are interested in this, which include the sellers of insurance, the insurers, the people that carry long-term care insurance, and the department. Those discussions, I think, are still going to be ongoing. I expect there'll be some changes that the House will do that the Senate won't be doing, which will create more dialogue in the future conference committee about this, whether it be in the omnibus conference or in a standalone conference committee. And members, at this point, I would urge you to read carefully, especially the state recovery part. If there's a concern members have today, I'm willing to address that in taking out some sentences, especially to create more dialogue. Because my desire is to make this simple. There's a $2 million fiscal note, which is based on health match and some other staff. And frankly, members, I find it appalling. I think that we've got the health match thing is just out of control. And we've tried hard to get this to go, and we're going to spend the money somewhere or other. And health match, it's a preliminary note. I'm told that they're going to come back at the omnibus time and tell us how much it's really going to cost. But I want to say at the table that I think we're being taken to the cleaners. I hear from my constituents and from people that know about this stuff. My kid helps me with my computer work. So Steve Vetter, I call him up, and he helps me. I can set my own date, I think, kind of stuff. But I'm not good at this. But people are, and they have contracts. And here we have a program that's going to help people protect their assets. And it costs us $2 million that we don't have to put toward it. And I just think that's ridiculous. We heard about the other one before, and enough editorials, but I think that the Department of Nowhere are not happy about that. And anyway, so, and also in the estate recovery, I want it to be simple. I want this to be a simple plan. If you buy the insurance, you're protected for $100,000. You don't have to get a lawyer at the end of the year when you're dead, or when you're getting the money you've taken for your estate or whatever, to fight this against the department. And I'm concerned that the language that's in here on the recovery makes it hard. And so with those editorials, Mr. Chair, unless members want to offer an amendment to my amendment, which I would embrace right now on the state recovery part, I'm offering an A4 amendment to you.
Thank you, Representative Abler. We'll incorporate those changes, the oral changes you had. So just again for members, it was line 1.4, strike may, add shall, and what was the second portion? And strike insurers.
And Mr. Chair, before I adopt the amendment, is there any member who would like to offer any advice on pages 5, 6, and 7 of the amendment?
Representative Trimba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I had a couple of questions. And as I'm reading through this, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it looks like if, let's say, my spouse had needed medical assistance, I'd be able to retain my farm. I'll use those words. And then as it goes along, I can probably pass it on to my children, but my grandchildren would have to pay the bill for my spouse.
Is that what I'm reading?
The department.
Representative
Mabler. I don't know the answer to that. Maybe you should have the department come up and answer that question, Mr. Chair.
I see no one jumping out of their seats yet. Anyone from the department want to comment on this?
They heard my talk and they don't want to come down and sit by me, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record and
My name is Kim Carlin from the Department of Human Services. Representative Otremba, can you repeat the question again?
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, as I read this, it looks like if I had a spouse and he collected medical, he used medical assistance, my assets would be protected. My kids now buy the farm on a market value, and they get it, or maybe they don't. Maybe I give it to them. Whatever. They would be okay with the protected assets, but my grandchildren would then have to pay the Medicaid bill.
Ms. Carlin.
First, let me say, Mr. Chair, Representative Otremba, that the community spouse asset protection is separate from this provision. This has no effect. It would not change the provisions of spousal impoverishment provisions of law. In terms of your question about the grandchildren paying, I can take that question back and have people in estate recovery address that and get back to you. But in terms of medical assistance eligibility, the community spouse protection is not affected by these provisions. This would be an addition.
Well, Mr. Chair, on page 7, line 17, it says, does not apply to any of the heirs, successors, assigns, or transferees of those individuals. And that's what's, maybe you can, I don't know what that means then. Because it seems to cut out a piece of asset protection.
Ms. Carlin.
And it seems to apply to real property. And so
Mr. Chair, Representative Otremba, Joe Rubenstein is the person who worked with us on these provisions. I will take your question back to Mr. Rubenstein and get an answer to you, if that's okay.
Wow.
See no further discussion. All those.
Chair.
You need to thank you.
They didn't like my pocket. Kevin did that.
It's a bad idea.
We're not going to be able to come back. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how long it's going to be outside. So.
Take it up tomorrow.
Can we just vote the amendment on?
Yeah, that's what I'm worried about. Is let's at least vote the amendment on. Get that. Well, Mr. Chair, why don't we do that? Let's vote the amendment on. Get that.
All right. Representative Abel renews his A4 amendment. All those in favor of the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment passes.
Chair, just one quick question. I don't know. Is there other people that were going to testify? Because this is going to go on to another committee. And I'm worried we're going to lose a day here or something.
Are we going to move it out right now then?
Well, it seems like, are we ready to move it out?
It comes back anyway, Mr.
It's got to come back here for the money parts anyway.
I'm going to move my motion to go to Commerce.
Yeah, why don't we,
as I was trying to say earlier, see no further discussion. Representative Avery renews his motion that the House File 3283 as amended be recommended pass and be referred to Committee on Commerce. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay? Amendment, motion passes.
Mine will just be another day, so let's just adjourn.
Meeting is adjourned.